Right, boys and girls, those of us here, hello. And a small group sits up here determined separate floors. Glad you're looking at them, I can see why. Page 69, securities regulation. Let's start into this fun stuff. Securities regs, exciting stuff. There is a very well-known professor of Phoenix Corporate Finance who once said, you can't teach this stuff to students, they won't understand it, and I don't agree, because that suggests you're stupid and you're clearly not. We are talking about how we regulate securities markets and the ways in which securities can be marketed to the general public. Okay? So that's what we've got in mind. That's our subject matter. And I'll talk about what securities are in a second. In terms of what are you going to be asked to do ultimately, you know, what's the assessable question here? I put this on the company law syllabus for last year, and it came up in really three separate things. Okay, it can be a question on how do the regulations apply to a set of facts in front of you for someone that's trying to issue some securities. Principally, what are the prospectus requirements? I'll explain what all this means as we go through. But that's been the first thing that can be the subject matter of a problem, if you like. How do the prospectus rules, prospectus requirements, apply to a set of facts? Okay. And so you've got actually the same problem that was on the company law course last year in your seminar materials. Why a PLC are about to issue some new shares to the public. You get told about a bunch of stuff that's going on with their business, and basically what should they be required to put in the prospectus is what you're being asked. Okay? And the key concept is that a prospectus must contain all the, quote, necessary information. So that's what we'll spend a lot of time discussing from the statute and from the rules, what's meant by necessary information. Okay? It's a very, very simple central concept. You're looking at the facts and thinking, well, what's necessary to tell the public? Just one nice big central idea. The second thing which can get lashed in with all of that, bless you, which will be familiar to many of you, I hope, is straightforward liability for negligent misrepresentation, negligent misstatement. Yeah, Hedley, Byrne and Heller, Caparo and Dickman, all that stuff you will have done in common law too, which hopefully will sound vaguely familiar to those of you who did it last year or those of you who have just done it, depending on your degree program. In effect, what we're going to be asking is whether or not Caparo and Dickman would still apply in the same way, given all the prospectus regulation that now exists. To make a long story short, if you remember Caparo and Dickman, one of the issues there in relation to a takeover, Fidelity PLC, a whole load of stuff we'll talk about, was whether or not a statement should have been considered to have been made to the whole public at large or only to a narrow group of people, yeah? And so there's all that stuff about thresholds and slippery slopes and floodgates and all that good taught language, yeah? Prospectus regulation now makes it obligatory that if you're issuing shares, you have to make certain types of information available to everyone in the world. So actually, this ability when issuing securities or getting involved in takeovers and all kinds of things to say you're only going to provide information to narrow groups of people just isn't possible under the regulation anymore. So there's an interesting little twist, if you enjoy it, taught. maybe it's just a twist. For you to think about, well, does Caparo and Dickman still apply in the same way on its own facts, given the takeover code, for example, in relation to takeovers specifically, and a number of other cases that we're going to look at that aren't ever on the taught syllabi, Al-Naqib and POSFund and so on and so forth, where different approaches are taken as to whether or not we can deem information to be made publicly available or whether it's only meant to be for the eyes and ears of a particular narrow group. Okay? So that fun play about, again, what's the regulation saying we should do in relation to finance and what's the general law saying at the same time. Okay? So the second thing that can come up in problems, therefore, is sticking in some liability for negligence as well as what are you required to do by the prospectus rules, what are your liabilities in tort if you don't. We'll also look at Section 90 of the Financial Services Markets Act, FSMA, which provides for a statutory tort, if you like, because the directive says it has to. And we'll kind of compare and contrast. Is there any difference at all between the general tort of negligence and Section 90? And then the way it also came up in company law last year was a general discussion about information. What is all this regulation doing in terms of the provision of information to investors? And you might lash that together with insider dealing and all those things you talked about in criminal law already. It was really at the heart of securities regulation, to put it all in a nutshell. It's about creating positive obligations on people who are issuing securities to provide certain types of information to the public. And that, I would suggest, is pretty much all that securities regulation does to protect those investors. It says you're provided with this information and then you're on your own path. If you decide to invest in something stupid, providing you've been given the right information, then tough luck. So in terms of investor protection, about all we've got in terms of investor protection have been things like COBs, you've talked about before, that you've got to be treated suitably, sold any suitable products. All the securities regulation is concerned about, specifically beyond all of that stuff, the financial promotion regulation on how you can be advertised things, is, would you shut up? Is then how you go that little bit further and say, well, when you've decided to invest in securities, all the regulation requires is that information is given to the market. It's then up to those people. It's a market, after all, for them to decide what they want to invest in. If they lose money, tough luck. Your liability is only on the basis that you haven't given the information properly. So, for example, it's incorrect or it's misleading or there's some negligent misrepresentation or misstatement. It's not any kind of protection to say you won't suffer a loss. Okay. I think that's a key theme behind all this. And we might start to ask the question, you know, is that enough? Is that plus conduct of business regulation enough? Okay, so that's the big picture. That's what we're trying to focus on. And put like that, it's actually quite narrow. You know, kind of the accessible bit at the end is quite narrow. So page 69. Back through some stuff which will be vaguely familiar from earlier. And then I'll talk about what securities are a little bit before we head into the good old Lamfalussy process again. The sources of securities law. There is a book in the library written by me called Securities Law, which Nick promises is going to go on to short loan. There is also in Palmer's Company Law, which you can't get out of the library, in part 5. I write long sections there on how all these securities regulations function as well. Okay, I'm going to get some other stuff photocopied and scanned into Blackboard for you over the break as soon as I can get around to it. But otherwise, securities law, I do the same stuff in a bit more depth if you care. Because the sources of securities law are quite convoluted, but it's the same as we've talked about from the start of the course. The roots of all of this are EC directives. And there are really 4 of them. There's the Consolidated Admissions and Reporting Directive, which is every bit as exciting as it sounds. The car chase is stunning. The love interest, remarkable. The Consolidated Admission Reporting Directive, or CARD, from 2001, which consolidates a number of earlier directives. The Prospectus Directive 2004, on which we will spend a bit of time, which is the requirement that there must be a prospectus published in advance. And as far as we're concerned, this prospectus is the document which advertises the securities. Okay? So all this misrepresentation, statements and everything else, if they're going to be made anywhere, will be in that prospectus. Either because we think the prospectus doesn't provide all the necessary information, or because it does seek to provide all that but gets it wrong for some reason or says something misleading, okay? So that's where the tort and everything else is going to come in. The Transparency Obligations Directive 2005, which puts obligations on the issuers of securities after those securities have already been issued. Primarily, by transparency, we mean providing information as to who controls the shares in a company. So not necessarily who owns them, but who controls the people that own them. It's so that we know who owns companies in the background, so we know what's going on under the surface. Again, all about information. And then MiFID, the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, about which you already know a lot, conduct of business, how these things can be sold, and so on and so forth. We'll come back to MiFID a bit later on in the end. And so, as is the way with European legislation, what we're going to focus on, the law as far as we're concerned, is the law in the UK. As we know, all directives must be implemented. And under English law, or given that this now covers the whole of the UK, because of course the UK is the member state, so this is now UK financial services law, this stuff only becomes UK law once it's been implemented. So it's the implementing rules and regulations that we're looking for as being the law we're going to consider. The directives are going to be useful for our purposes because they have nice broad statements as to their economic objectives. So if we want to make policy statements, commentary statements, we do all that way. Okay? Everyone's having a wild time outside and we're in here. So the principal UK legislation is the Financial Services Markets Act 2000, FSMA. FSMA has been updated and amended a number of times, which makes FSMA quite confusing. So confusing that a number of books on company law have completely missed that most of it's completely changed. Because what tends to happen with the updates is that instead of repealing the existing FSMA and then putting new things in, new sections have simply been added to the old stuff. It's a bit like when you... Haven't the Blairs done this with a house they've got somewhere in very posh bits of West London? They've kept the facade and then just gutted everything behind it. So it looks like it's the same house because it's got the same front wall and front door, but behind that everything is literally different. It's been gutted and rebuilt. It's the same kind of idea. So it looks as though it runs from section 79 of FSMA onwards. But actually, section 85 has been redrafted, and then there's 87A through M or O, I can't remember how many letters it goes. So a whole load of stuff has been added. So company law textbooks can get a bit maddeningly confusing on all of this. There's also been the Companies Act 2006, which implements the Transparency Obligations Directive. That was, I think, just by way of convenience, because the Companies Act was coming in, they thought we can put that in there. Those of us doing company law, have we done raising capital and those kind of things in company law yet?
Doing it now.
Doing it now. Are you doing FSMA and all that kind of stuff in there? Are you doing the Public Office of Securities regulations? Do you know 1995? Or are you doing prospectus regulations?
No.
Okay. All right. Okay. Never mind. Because the key regulations now in the UK are the Prospectus Regulations 2005. Prospectus Regulations 2005 quote, revoked a lot of the old law, and lots of company law books are still talking about the old statutes, which in fact most of it was revoked in 2005, and new provisions added to FSMA. So it all gets a bit intricate. People out there in practice get very upset about it. How does all this fit together? Because unless you're keeping a hold on, unless you do this for a living and nothing else, it's quite difficult to keep a hold on. And then what happens is that legislation, primarily FSMA, as it's been updated and everything else, creates criminal offences along the lines of Section 85 of FSMA, we're going to spend a lot of time on, says it's an offence to try and offer securities to the public or to have securities admitted to trading on a regulated market unless there's a prospectus. So we're going to talk about 85 in detail, but just to give you the kind of headline. So FSMA tends to do things like that. If you don't do this, it's a criminal offence. And then FSMA gives powers to the FSA to create detailed regulations. So the detail of the rules then is in the FSA securities regulations. Okay. Now handily, if you look all this stuff up on the FSA website, they have all of their own regulations, and they basically copy and paste in the key provisions from the directives and from FISMA as well. And so it's becoming cases of materials more and more. So on the FSA website, we've got three types of securities regulations: the listing rules, the prospectus rules, and the disclosure and transparency rules. Okay. So three separate rule books that together make up the securities regulations. And so when I talk about securities regulations, it's those FSA regulations that I'm talking about. Okay. So that's the UK law, because that's how all the EC directives have been implemented. So that is the UK law. The other reason why we need to look at the UK law and just not deal at the level of the directives, which some company law textbooks do, they don't talk about the UK regulations at all, they just talk about the directives, is that the directives specifically give power to member states to gold plate their own regulations. And by gold plate we mean, this is somebody else's jargon, not mine, by gold plate we mean you can make your domestic regulations more stringent in the EC directives if you want. So we're going to talk a bit later on about, is this harmonisation or what do we call this? Remember, the European Union wanted to harmonise all of the laws amongst the member states in this area once upon a time. But because individual member states are able to gold plate their law, make it more stringent than the EC minimum, by definition we're not harmonising our laws, we're not making our laws the same. And in the UK, we have sought to make our laws more stringent than everywhere else, so that we can say, if you come to the UK and issue your securities here, we have a market with greater integrity, because we have all these fabulous regulations, they're far more detailed and demanding, so investors in the UK market can have more confidence, this is the theory, because any issuer here in the UK will have had to jump over these higher hurdles. More information, better information is made available to you here. Come to London, do your stuff in London. Yes. Thank you. Some of you are writing courses of your own. Okay, so that's gold plating. That's another reason why we have to focus, I would suggest, on the UK provisions as opposed to just at the EC level. And those are a tendency in a lot of books to do just that. Okay, and then we also have to look to our final source for securities law generally, is English general law. Okay, for our purposes, we're concerned about the English law on tort, a little bit of fiduciary stuff. If we're doing this in Scotland, we'll be talking about delict and all those kind of fun things they have in Scotland instead of tort. Okay. Notice they pronounce it delict and not delight. Let's just spend a few seconds on what some of that language means and what securities are. Okay, let's just try and do some vocab. In the old days, you used to have to divide between two types of securities. You don't anymore, but this might make sense of what some of the other company law books are doing. Because somewhere you might go and try and look up this kind of stuff. If you want another account of this, is find a decent company law textbook. So, for example, in Garen Davies on company law in the library, there's a long discussion of the prospectus directive, albeit not very much on the UK stuff. So you might look at some of the company law books. And they tend to differentiate between, I'm going to have to turn my back on you, sorry, listed and unlisted securities. Okay. The principal market for securities in the UK is the main market on the London Stock Exchange. Okay. Capital M, capital M, main market. Okay, that's what it's called on the London Stock Exchange. Oh God, I've written LSE. Terrible thing. The big public companies, the big public limited companies that we've all heard of, all those household names, everything on the FTSE 100 and beyond, all those big companies are all quoted on the main market on the London Stock Exchange. Okay? As part of its activities, the FSA maintains something which is known as the official list. And the official list is the list maintained by the FSA as the UK's, quote, competent authority of all the biggest public limited companies that have complied with the so-called listing rules, the FSA listing rules, which require a whole load of, a whole extra dimension of provision of information, corporate organisation and compliance, which you have to go to get onto the official list. There was a lot of expense and a lot of hard work involved in getting things listed and complying with those regulations. The idea being, once you've complied with those regulations and you're on the official list, and you are therefore a listed company, you have listed securities, that's what that expression means, you'll see a lot in the literature. You're saying to your investor base, we've complied with all those regulations, all that information is made available to you, our accounts comply with all that kind of stuff and so on and so forth, we're therefore on the official list. And so in the old days, there were very different regulations between listed securities on the one hand and unlisted securities on the other. So before FSMA, we used to have the Financial Services Act 1986, used to deal with listed securities, and the so-called Public Offers of Securities Regulations 1995, which a lot of the company law books still talk about as though it's the law, all revoked in 2005. Okay, so be careful with the company law books. A lot of company lawyers have just missed this. That all of the POS regulations over there were revoked. So in the old days, it used to be important to know whether or not you were on the official list or not, because there were completely different regulations. Okay. The reason why things changed is in 2004 with the Prospectus Directive. You see, in the world of listed versus unlisted, if you were going to be listed, you had to prepare a document called Listing. And if you go and look at FSMA now, in section 79 it still says listing particulars are required, which is slightly confusing. This is why a lot of company lawyers missed on this, because they looked at the act and said, oh, well, that's still there. The Prospectus Directive, now section 85 and FSMA 2000, says that it's a criminal offence not to have a prospectus. Okay? And actually what's happened, what I said before about having the facade on the house, but having gutted everything behind, is that actually it's prospectuses we need to worry about now. Okay? So the Prospectus Directive is implemented by a statutory instrument, the Prospectus Regulations 2005. So on your handout, the UK legislation, Prospectus Regulation 2005. Why they've been difficult to spot for some lawyers, I'm not being mean, but because they're under P for prospectus, and not under F for Financial Services and Markets Act, and not under C for Companies Act, means a lot of people didn't know where to find them. Remember when they were being implemented on 1st of July 2005, and I was hunting around for ages thinking, where are these bloody things? And eventually finally found them. I thought, what about P? And sure enough, there they were. Thousands and thousands of statutory instruments are very easy to miss. So it's section 85 of the Financial Services and Markets Act that says, if you don't have a prospectus authorised by the Financial Services Authority, you commit a criminal offence. And so we'll look at section 85 in detail. But if you want to have a look now, it's on page 71, so we'll go through this in more detail. If we quick flick onto page 71, I'll just show you the provision. Section 85, on page 71, 4.2, it's unlawful for transferable securities to which this subsection applies to be offered to the public in the United Kingdom unless an approved prospectus has been made available to the public before the offer is made. And then under heading 4.4, section 85, subsection 2, it's unlawful to request the admission of transferable securities to which this subsection applies to trading on a regulated market situated or operating in the United Kingdom unless an approved prospectus has been made available to the public before the request is made. So we've got two different activities there. Okay. Section 85, we're going to go through this in a lot of detail, but just to give you kind of the map, because it is a bit dense, and I think having an overview map is helpful. Section 85.1 says, well, Section 85.1 relates to offers made to the public. Okay. An offer of securities to the public. And the definition of the public is incredibly broad. It's basically an offer to anyone. If I want to put the provision on the handout. The idea was here to make this as broad as possible, to capture as many securities issues as possible. So this will relate to public companies where the shares are available to the public, any offer that's made to the public, or under 85.2, seeking to admit securities to a regulated market. The FSA maintains a list in the UK of markets which are regulated. We will keep using the example of the London Stock Exchange. Okay, it's the key one, but there are lots of other markets as well. The kind of NASDAQ-y, all these newcomers count as regulated markets too. Asking what is a regulated market, you just look up what's on the FSA's list today. Because here's how this works. If you want to offer securities to the public in the UK, you have to do two things. You have to go to the FSA and get authorisation for your prospectus so that you can offer those securities. And you have to find a regulated market that's going to admit them so they can be traded publicly so people can buy and sell them. So there's two things going on at once. Before you'll get authorisation from the FSA, you have to comply with the FSA's prospectus rules. And the power for the FSA to create those rules is set out in Section 85 and those following. And to breach any of that is a criminal offence. So that's the map of what we're doing. That's the root of it. Okay, we need to have prospectuses. So all of this distinction between listed and unlisted is now gone. Yeah, we don't care in the first place about whether something's listed or not. Our question now is, are you going to offer these securities to the public, or are you going to seek their trading on a regulated market? Either of those things, you've got to comply with prospectus regulations. Okay. So what we'll talk about is, what do those regulations require? What are the kind of things that go into prospectuses? Okay. The only reason we now care about whether things are listed or not is that there still are the listing rules which offer a set of regulatory requirements over and above the prospectus requirements. A lot of, for example, continuing obligations on you to make certain kinds of information public on an ongoing basis in relation to your securities. So if you look at the FT most days, you see there have been announcements made by companies. These are being made typically through the stock exchange or, you know, to the FSA, made public in those ways because something's happened to the company, something's affecting its business or whatever else. Typically lots of things like that are prompted by the listing rules. So the only reason we care now about listed versus unlisted is whether or not you need to comply with all of these regulations to get yourself onto, for example, the London Stock Exchange and onto this official list. Okay? So be careful reading anything old. The old days, all we cared about was listed versus unlisted. Now, there's this whole requirement for prospectuses first. Okay? That comes first. And Section 102B of FSMA 2000 tells us that the public is incredibly broad, as we'll see in later sessions. Okay? Just deliberately very broad. We're trying to bring everything under the umbrella, and then there are statutory exceptions. Okay, so that's how this works. We have a long list of exceptions, having said pretty much everything is caught. Very different from the old approach. Okay. Very good. And then transparency obligations, as we say, we'll talk about that much later on, after Christmas. Transparency obligations are things you're required to do once your securities have been issued. Let's talk about what some of these securities are, having just given you an idea for that. Our principal focus then is on prospectuses. I'm encouraging you to read other things, particularly company law texts, talk about this kind of stuff, but just to be careful that they are talking about prospectuses and not just about the old stuff. Let's think about some of the classic types of securities. Shares. What else are there? Bonds that we've already talked about. Bless you. We'll talk about securitized derivatives. I think I meant to talk about convertibles in there too. With securities, we're talking about anything which is issued and is transferable, whether by a company or by a government. Okay? One of the things I kept trying to remind myself to talk about when we talk about bonds is the fact that, for example, governments can issue bonds. If you've been watching the press over the last little while, Greece has got itself into some slight difficulties about its sovereign debt. When we talk about the government borrowing, how much is the government going to borrow this year or whatever else, actually what the government does is it issues bonds, government bonds, T-bills in the United States. And it's seeking people to be ordinary investors in those bonds. So governments are doing that too. And Greece has been downgraded. It's been the big news recently. The Greek Prime Minister gave a speech. Is he Prime Minister or President? Something like that. And he's admitted to there being endemic amounts of corruption within Greece generally, which is hugely embarrassing. And the credit rating's been downgraded, and they're talking about, you know, what's going to happen to Iceland, what's going to happen to Spain, and what's going to happen to the UK as well. If our debt stays as high as it is, will we lose our AAA rating and will the country come down? Because if, for example, the UK stopped being rated AAA for its bonds, it would become much more expensive, meaning if the UK government issued bonds, it would have to start paying a higher rate of interest to borrowers if the rating agencies decided it's no longer rated AAA. So we're still in exactly that idea, and the stuff we were talking about over the last couple of weeks about bonds and rating agencies has been all over the news, even now as it relates to governments. So we tend to rate governments in the same way that we're rating Nike and we're rating ICI and all these other companies as well. It's an odd world in which we start giving scores to governments. Or countries, and that's what the World Cup's for. So some of the key securities we're talking about on these markets, okay, are going to be shares or equities, as they're often referred to in bankers' parlance. That use of the word equity is always slightly an odd one for a lawyer, of course, because we know what equity means. Or occasionally we think we do. So shares, as we know, depending on the type of share, an ordinary share in a company will give you a right to participate in dividends if there are any dividends declared, if the company has distributable profits. Okay, the idea being companies are only allowed to declare dividends out of profits. This will be familiar to those of you doing company law. The great thing about a share in a public limited company is that there will be a public market available for you to sell and buy those shares. So your investment bet as a shareholder might be, in the long term, that you want to receive a stream of income in the form of dividends, or it might be short term and speculative, that you're hoping the price of those shares will rise, you can sell them off at a profit. So that's a fairly straightforward type of security. Bonds, we know about, we talked about them as well. A company or a government can borrow money. Instead of taking out a loan, simply by issuing securities called bonds. Sometimes in company law parlance, the references to them as debentures and debenture stock and all kinds of old-fashioned words. Bonds is the word we use in the 21st century. As we know, the issuer of the bond pays an interest, amount of interest on each bond. Periodically through the life of the bond. As a bond holder, as an investor in a bond, you acquire a right to interest, therefore, you acquire a right to be repaid your capital at the end of the bond period, but you don't acquire a right to interest. You are able, because securities are transferable, to simply sell your bond in the market. Buy it at one price, and then if the bond price goes up, you hope sell it at another. So in that sense, that you can buy and sell it on an open market, bonds resemble shares. It's a different market with different things prodding it. Because bonds pay you a rate of interest, the value of a bond is usually, could you get a better rate of interest than that somewhere else in a different market? So your bond will seem more or less attractive, depending on A, how reliable the company that's issued it is, how reliable the government has issued it is, and whether or not you could get a better rate of interest somewhere else from somebody else in a different product. So that's what bond markets are sensitive to. Shares are more directly sensitive to the earnings that that company is generating compared to each share that's in issue. How much profit is there per share, basically. There are also things called convertibles, which are worth mentioning. Convertibles are securities which start life typically as a bond, but can be converted into shares. And we can see the attraction to this. The attraction of a bond is that you're guaranteed a rate of interest, assuming the company's solvent and behaves itself. Yeah, you know you're going to get that nice rate of income. The trouble, the risk with a share, if what you're waiting on is a dividend, is you're hoping the company has enough profit. So in a lean period, you might decide when you want a bond to start with, so you've got the contractual security, you're going to get your coupon interest payment. But if you think the company's profits might fare better in the future, you might want your right to be convertible, so you can convert it into a share instead. So if you think the dividends will improve in the future, the terms of this convertible will state on what dates, at what times, subject to what conditions precedent you're entitled to convert from a bond into a share. Usually you won't just be able to do it because you feel like it one Wednesday morning. There'll be particular time periods. It'll be stipulated who is it who gets to make that election. I mean, this is all just about negotiation, really. If the company's desperate for the money, they'll give you what you want. How like life. That's how convertibles work. You can see how, if you think the dividend stream is going to be better, you're going to get more by way of dividend than you would have got by way of ordinary coupon interest, then you'd rather have a share. That's what the convertible is about. Lots of restrictions on company law, in company law rather, about cancelling shares. So it's slightly more complicated to start off with a share and have that share cancelled and it become a bond instead. There are lots of requirements of the company that you'd have to comply with first, so they're not as common, okay, because there are lots of complications in company law. The company law concerns are not wanting the company to reduce its capital. One of the great concerns, Trevor and Whitworth, 1879, why do I remember these things? I mean, the House of Lords doesn't want the company ever to be able to reduce its capital so that there's less left behind to satisfy unsecured creditors' debts. That's one of the great concerns of company law. So there are huge restrictions on companies buying back their own shares and cancelling shares and so on and so forth unless they go through the appropriate statutory procedure. Okay. So that's what's at the back of all of that. There are other kinds of shares. Typically, we're going to be focusing on ordinary shares. And so when I'm talking about shares, I'll just have ordinary shares in mind. But there are other kinds of shares. There are preference shares, for example. Preference shares typically guarantee you a dividend. And in that sense, a lot of people say, well, that's just like a bond, really. Ordinary shares, it depends on potluck, really, as to how many distributable profits there are in any given year. Your dividend could be large or it could be small. Preference shareholders usually are guaranteed an amount of dividend. Okay. The thing about dividends is they have to be paid out of profit, again, because the company can't reduce its capital. So you can't dig into your capital to pay dividends. The same reason, we don't want the company secretly, if you like, to be paying all its capital out to its shareholders so there's none left for the creditors in case the company fails. That's, again, the policy reason, you know, a century and more old behind all of that. So ordinarily, your preference share will guarantee you a dividend. Sometimes preference shares carry voting rights of ordinary shareholders. Sometimes preference shares don't. Sometimes what people do, if they are going to provide capital to a company, they're not really bothered about whether they have voting rights or not. They just want a cash return, is to trade up the amount of dividend they're going to get for not having voting rights, which is quite attractive if it's your company. Now, if you're in control of a public company, you don't want to destabilise the shareholder balance by letting somebody else in. If they'll agree to have no voting rights and just get paid a bit more money, you might think that's worth it. Okay? So preference shares are there as well. And you can muck about with the rights attaching to ordinary shares and preference shares as much as you like. Lots of companies have lots of different classes of shares as a result. And that can all get quite complicated. There are then securitised derivatives, which are really quite new on this market. One of the things we'll talk about when we do derivatives and when we talk about the banking crisis at the end of the course is whether or not it's possible to take something, derivatives, which have always been privately negotiated between two parties, have always been done off exchange, and historically were never appearing on people's balance sheets. Can we standardise them enough so they can be traded on a stock exchange? And the advances in derivatives over the years is that there are lots of very basic to make life simple, options to buy and sell shares, options to buy and sell bonds, which have become so standardised now that it's possible to treat them as being securities. So you can issue things that are effectively an option to buy your own shares on the marketplace. Everyone has exactly the same rights, whoever's holding those securitised derivatives at any particular time. So this is a new addition to securities regulation, mention of these securities, securitised derivatives. Okay, so that's the main securities that we're thinking of when we talk about securities regulation. Okay, jolly good. All right, a bit of vocab. 69, just to shove us on to some of this more stuff and into some of the policy questions, we're back to Lamfalussy, which I'm sure you remember from September, October, whatever that was. The fabulously named Baron Lamfalussy. I still want him to be in some kind of biplane with a big handlebar moustache. I deliberately haven't looked up a photograph because I don't want to know. Belgian central banker was charged with the role of looking at how the European Union created its legislation. And the real problem always was securities markets. And the Lamfalussy process was focused on securities markets. It's subsequently been played out across the whole of financial services, but it started just with securities. Because the 1993 Investment Services Directive introduced a whole new regulatory framework across the European Union that was pretty much out of date as soon as it was implemented, because derivatives had happened in the meantime, and therefore we had lots and lots of new products in the securities firmament that we'd never heard of before. So the idea was, Lamfalussy process, let's make our legislation more streamlined, because the Investment Services Directive took a long, long time to emerge. And then we went from 1993 to, 2004 and MiFID before we got to update that. I mean, it was taking a decade just to produce the directive. Ah, it does look exactly what I thought a Belgian central bank would look like. Thank you very much. I wanted a moustache on there, so I wanted something far more. He's a baron. He should be far more exciting. Anyway, maybe that is just me. The Lamfalussy process is all about speeding up, if you remember all this kind of stuff. It's all about high-level framework principles. My voice cracking with the emotion. Okay, so we're going to use directives. This is 2.1 on the handout, to produce framework principles. This is supposed to make us much more nimble. Yes, it's much easier to change the high-level principles every once in a while in a directive. It's much easier for the Commission to deal with the details, technical regulations. If you're one of those people that's very suspicious of how the European Union works or doesn't work, then you're going to say, well, this is just giving more and more power to the Commission. If all those detailed technical regulations are down at that level with the Commission, and if the devil is in the detail, then the Commission literally is the devil. Yeah? That's kind of where you'd go there if you're writing a Daily Mail front page. Okay? Devil's in the detail, Commission is the devil. That's where we've got to there. So, Peter Mandelson was there for a long time as a commissioner, so that would make him Satan. Or the Prince of Darkness, as he likes to be known. I used to work for Peter years ago. He's such a nice man. Seriously, he's one of the first MPs I've ever worked for. I used to give him advice on the tax policy when he was doing the finance bills. Very, very nice man. To pop round to his flat for breakfast, and then drop off the briefing notes, have a chat, and go on. And then he decided to be the Prince of Darkness. It's very, very odd. It must be a deliberate decision. He has a sense of humour as well. When he was the Minister Without Portfolio, he had a portfolio briefcase made with Minister Without Portfolio across the top of it. People used to sneer and go, you're stupid, you haven't got a portfolio. Yes, I know, it's a joke. He does have a sense of humour, but I don't understand why he's turned out like he has. Anyway, he's such a nice young boy. He's sounding like his mother. So there we are. So the Commission technical regulations, you know, there is a point there, somewhere about what I was saying, about the Commission having too much power. You know, if all those detailed regulations are being left over to the Commission, is that a good or a bad thing? Did we prefer long-winded but with more public oversight, which leads you to the question, was there ever actually any real oversight? Did Parliament ever really look at this kind of stuff at the European level, let alone the UK? But that was the idea. That's all left up to the Commission. Then CSER is supposed to bring all the securities regulators together so that they can share best practice, discuss any issues between themselves, to have an international forum. Kind of like the United Nations, but for banking regulators. And I'm sure they're called the Committee of European Securities Regulators because it sounds like Caesar when you say the acronym out loud. Anyway, there we are. It is Europe after all. And then an enforcement mechanism affected by the Commission underneath is the idea, to make sure these regulations are being put across. So what is it we're trying to do? Themes 2.2. Harmonisation is what everyone talks about. I've noticed some of the EU specialists talking about approximate harmonisation since. It depends what you think harmonisation is about. The words that are used in CARD, the Consolidated Emission Reporting Directive, and this is the Prospectus Directive, for example, are words like approximation of laws or the coordination of laws. That's not the same as making them the same. That you try and approximate them means you bring them more broadly together. Because the problem was, as you have discussed in the EU law, that we have one way of doing things in France, one way of doing things in the UK, one way of doing things in Germany, before the European Union starts to intervene. So it was very, very difficult to deal across markets. Very difficult for one company, for example, to raise money in Germany and raise money in France and raise money in the UK. The idea now, of course, is that we have a passport across the European Union, fourth bullet point, that once you have authorisation from one member state, that acquires you a licence for the whole of the European Union. So this is how we're trying to create a single market for capital across the entire EU. You get authorised in one place, you can then go and raise anywhere. So the idea is we have suddenly a massive pan-European market for securities funds. Now, a number of jurisdictions in the EU traditionally have always stuck to borrowing. Yeah, Germans are very big on this culturally, for example. At Westdeutsche Landesbank, of which you'll have heard if you've done property too, were one of the German lenders bank who tend to be very close to businesses in their region. And they tend to lend for the long term. And one of the great advantages that Will Hutton and others always identify that kind of German model is how close the banks become to the people they're lending to. It's a much closer relationship, very unlike talking to a lot of British banks, where trying to get to know anybody and build a relationship is quite difficult because you go through a call centre and all that kind of other stuff. You know, let alone the last couple of years when trying to borrow money for small businesses has been really hard. So it's quite a cultural shift for the whole of Europe to shift to what's always been known as Anglo-Saxon finance. Okay? There's always this idea that using securities markets in this way is Anglo-Saxon. And it's no surprise that it's been through the 1990s and up to about 2007 that we've seen across Europe more enthusiasm for this, because America was booming. The UK's financial services sector was booming. Yeah, French banks, German banks were all wanting to be more like American banks, you know, the type of business they were into. I mean, we've studied Westdeutsche Landesbank and Islington, their interaction, trying to get into the swaps markets, for example, and how all that went horribly wrong. There was a story in the financial press just last week, before, that WestLB, as they've become now, Westdeutsche Landesbank became WestLB, have just been bailed out for the fourth time. Our favourite Westdeutsche Landesbank, still up to their old tricks. Bless. Fourth time bailout. You would have thought the second or third would have warned you you wouldn't be doing something else, opening a cake shop or something, but no, you know, need to be bailed out for the fourth time. I hope if we all go bust, we'll get bailed out too. You know, us individually, I think the government should step in with 60 billion and help me. I promise to be much better. So this has been a huge cultural change. It's worth just watching a lot of the discussions that are going on at the European level now. There's a lot of this discussion, Sarkozy and people slagging off the Anglo-Saxon model. We've given a speech a little while ago. I've got some video as well I'll bring in from a few months ago about them slagging off, you know, the model Anglo-Saxon. We should go back to being more prudent, we should go back to being more European, is the idea. So this is where all this has come from, and Lamfalussy is very, very Anglo-American. And what we keep going at, and I love this metaphor, I know I banged on about this back in September, but I do like it, deep pools of liquid capital. It's such a beautiful idea, yes? Sitting here in December, wondering how hard it's going to snow tomorrow, and just imagining deep pools of anything, yes? It sounds nice to say deep pools. You're worried before exams, just say deep pools. Deep pools of liquid capital. It's the idea that there's just all this money out there just to mop up, and the securities markets will get at, you know, ordinary housewives in Bavaria. You know, there'll be, you know, people leaving university in Madrid that have all this spare cash. They just need to be encouraged to invest it in securities markets. Like Americans, historically, have always, you know, invested their money in shares and whatever else. Hence the big problem in the 1930s with the stock market crash. Hence the big problem today, because so many ordinary Americans invested. But it provides deep pools of liquid capital, is the idea. It's not just banks lending money. Everyone in the economy is supposed to be investing their money as well. So this is why it's thought to be a good model. There's a lot of cash there to facilitate and pay for all this lovely growth. So that's one of the key themes as well. That's a lot of the policy behind all this. So let's just, very quickly, 2.3. This is the first recycle to the Transparency Obligations Directive. So this is in the recycle. This is the first recycle to this directive. It shows how it's economic policy that's really driving all of this. Efficient, transparent and integrated securities markets contribute to a genuine single market, foster growth and job creation by better allocation of capital and by reducing costs. The disclosure of accurate, comprehensive and timely information builds sustained investor confidence and allows an informed assessment of their business performance and assets. This enhances both investor protection and market efficiency. It must be achieved by means of transparency for investors through a regular flow of information. So it's all about information. All of these regulations are ultimately about providing information, because the information builds sustained investor confidence. Now notice it's not it's a sustained investor protection. It's investor confidence that allows an informed assessment of business performance and assets. So it means ordinary investors have more information on which they can make their decisions. And it's hoped that that flow of information itself will enhance investor protection and market efficiency. So investors will be protected by having information. They're not going to be protected by us guarding against them losing anything. They're going to be protected by being given enough information. There is self-evidently a market ideology here. You give people information, you make sure it's appropriate information, there's no misleading in there, there's no misrepresentation, no fraud, but then it's up to people to make up their own minds. That's a market. Which raises the issue now about the banking crisis. If the state has to step in, is that a market anymore? You know, have we moved away from something? All those American senators, particularly people in the House of Representatives, the congressmen, saying this is un-American, this is socialism to have the government step in and save people. Because the market theory is, if you invest your money, there was no fraud involved, you invested it and you've lost it, tough luck. You know, it really is a kind of tough love thing, only without the love. But this is all ultimately about a genuine single market and fostering growth and job creation. So it's thought that this will lead directly to job creation, just making more information available in the securities markets. Yeah? Very, very close together, the idea that simply making more of the right kind of information available will have all these beneficial results. We're going to make jobs because people will be more confident, they'll invest their money, it'll all be wonderful. Okay, that's the theory. And the great political question now is, you know, do we believe in this anymore after the financial crash? I'll talk about it a bit tomorrow. Maybe I'll start with securitisations. One of the great concerns is, you know, is it exactly this kind of policy which led to the financial crisis? And would we be where we are now but for all of that? That sounds like a good cliffhanger. Let's leave that till tomorrow. Okay? Good-o.